This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Earlier this week, the president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute came to Hartford to talk about the work she's been doing in early childhood development. Coming up in a bit, we'll talk with Ellen Galinsky about her Mind in the Making initiative. Hartford Community Schools was chosen as one of a handful of communities around the nation meant to share life skills and give hands-on training for parents and educators. But first, we've been covering the laws governing learning disabled students on the show and how schools are teaching them. One school system has caught our attention, Darien, Connecticut, where the parents and school system seem to be in an all-out battle over transparency and how resources are being allocated to special education kids. In fact, last week, the State Department of Education released findings in the first part of an investigation that Darien schools violated federal and state special education law. To get the latest on this drama, we're joined by David DeRoche, who's assistant editor at the Darien Times, who's been covering this for us. He joins us on the phone. David, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me on, John.
And if you want to join us, 860-275-7266. Again, 860-275-7266. You can also email us wherewelive@wnpr.org. David, why don't you just lay out what this controversy is? Give us some background on what we're talking about here.
Sure. Well, since about 2009, the schools have been running over budget and special education expenses, and there's been a lot of pressure from town officials to rein in spending. So last year, they hired a new special education director who started work in July. And over the next several months, parents started noticing a difference in how the schools were working, and teachers and some administrators began to leave the district. The top speech and language professional left, autism inclusion specialist left, a number of aides left, were not replaced, many were not replaced. Parents formed an advocacy group in the fall to try to help each other navigate the complex web of special ed processes. But the problem seemed to get worse from their end. They approached the Board of Ed in January, telling them that they thought the schools were breaking the law. The Board of Ed backed away. My understanding is that they were advised from their attorneys to back away. And 2 months later, they filed a complaint with the State Department of Education, alleging the law breaking. And then we have the state coming back next week, basically confirming that the parents were correct.
Andrew Feinstein is an attorney representing the children with disabilities and their parents. He joins us by phone. Andrew, welcome to our program. Maybe you can lay out what is in this complaint, what these lawsuits are over.
Thank you, John. I appreciate being on. The issues were that there was a campaign, an effort by the Darien Board of Education to reduce the level of services for children with disabilities and to make it harder.
Are you still there? Oh, we heard to make it harder, and we lost your line. Now we've lost Andrew Feinstein. David DeRoche, what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to get Andrew Feinstein back on the line here. Maybe you can pick up where he left off there. What exactly are they alleging? He's talking about a campaign by the school district?
What people think has happened is that the district has kind of rallied against parents, and the schools have said that there's been a lot of spending in special education, and if you look at similar districts, their spending is less than what's been in Darien. So there's been a lot of pressure from the financiers in town to rein in spending, a lot of vocal public pressure. And, you know, I think parents and Mr. Feinstein see the district as kind of coming together in a united front to change the culture in town, to try to reduce services, deny services, and basically keep parents out of the decision-making process.
Well, I want to bring in Andrew Feinstein, who's back on the phone with us. And attorney, maybe you can just pick up again. I had David DeRoche lay out some of this. When you talk about a campaign by the schools, that's something very different than some sort of oversight. How do you prove that the schools have some sort of campaign against the parents with special education kids?
Well, it's clear from the documents that that have become available to us that this was a well-coordinated campaign directed by the special ed director under pressure from both the Board of Education and the Board of Finance.
Give us an example, please, for people who have not been following this story. What's a piece of evidence that you have?
Well, we have PowerPoint presentations made by the director of special education. We have internal memoranda sheets that she wrote. And we have a whole series of emails, some dealing with general matters, some dealing with specific children, ordering the cessation of services, ordering the reduction in staff levels, ordering determinations by the school administration prior to and outside the context of PPT meetings to determine the student's programs. The federal law provides a very clear structure on how these decisions are to be made in a collaborative process involving parents, and that was not done in Darien.
And just so the people understand, when you say a PPT meeting, what are you talking about?
That's called a pupil planning team meeting, where the school officials, the providers, the parents get together and design an appropriate educational program for a child. It's called a planning and placement team meeting. It's there's a requirement that you hold them at least annually and more frequently if there's a need to.
Let me bring in Stephen Falcone, who is the superintendent of schools in Darien, who joins us by phone today. Superintendent, welcome to our program. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please respond to these claims when Attorney Feinstein talks about a campaign with documentation to reduce the services for students who need special education in Darien? How do you respond?
Well, what I can tell you is, first, I don't agree with all of the aspects of that characterization that have been presented. But I do want to say that we've been grateful to the parents who shared their concerns and working with the State Department of Education. We're grateful to them for the work that they've done. And they've laid out some corrective actions for us and some recommendations in moving forward. And it's a path forward that we're going to work hard on, and we're doing it very promptly. And I've been here in the district connected to Darien for 21 years, and I think first and foremost what I'd say is that we're committed to making sure that every child in the school district has what he or she needs to be able to move forward, especially students with special needs.
When you say that the parents have pointed out some things that you've tried to take corrective actions about, what are you talking about? I mean, what was Darien clearly not doing right that the parents had to point out to you?
Well, I think that what was pointed out was part of the state report in terms of some materials that we had that were inconsistent, and we needed to address those. And what I can say is that when we became aware of that, when certainly I became aware of it back in April, I reached out to all of the teachers in the school district and to the community to reinforce the idea that all decisions do need to be made at that planning and placement team meeting, and they are individualized decisions. Not only did I do that, I went to every school building and met with the faculties in those school buildings to reinforce that. We've reached out to our parent community. We have a new special, special education advisory committee, and my door is open. And we've listened to those complaints and want to respond appropriately. And the people in our district, from me to every teacher really in the district, we're committed to what's best for our students and wanting to rebuild and move forward.
Here's one of the things that I've heard from parents in the Darien School Superintendent is that during these PPT meetings, the teachers involved who are part of this planning process, who would be helping to sign off on a special education plan for the students, were being pressured to, for lack of a better term, sit on their hands and not say that this student or that student might need special education from Darien. Is that part of the complaint that you've heard? Is that something specifically that you've tried to address?
Well, that's certainly part of the complaint that we've heard, but the planning, that's not a message that I've delivered, and in fact, I want every person who participates in that PPT process, which includes teachers, administrators, and parents, and related service providers, to be able to say what they believe is appropriate for the needs of every individual child. It is a team process, and that team, which does include parents, is responsible and important in making those decisions.
Attorney Feinstein, you've heard from the superintendent here. How do you think the school district has done in addressing some of these problems?
Well, what I can tell you is that we just came across an internal email sent from the Board of Finance to the Board of Education right after the complaint was filed back in March, saying that you can spend unlimited amount of money on lawyers to fight this complaint. And that's what we've seen, an aggressive effort to deny and to discredit the parent activities. What Dr. Falcone just said is perfectly appropriate, and we wish that had been the case and hope that it will be the case in the future. But, John, I want to say one other thing. The issue of cost in special education, the largest driver of that is out-of-district placements, is kids placed at private schools because the local school system cannot provide the services. Now, there are some children who are really very seriously disabled for whom an out-of-district placement is imperative. But what's happened in Darien is because of the reduction in services, the reduction in the number of staff, the reduction in the number of speech pathologists, that children are not now being, or have not over the last year, been afforded an appropriate education, and the number of out-of-district placements has skyrocketed. It is far less expensive over the long run and probably even over the short run for Darien to invest in a powerful, appropriate special ed program than to try to cut corners on the in-district program, which just forces people out of district and forces up the cost.
So here's an email we got from Lucero about this, and I'll address it to you, Attorney, given what you just said. And here's what the email says. What percentage of the budget should go to special ed needs? Darien spends more than 30% of the budget, and parents feel it's not enough. Where should we draw the line, 40, 50, or as much as it takes? Is that fair with the rest of the kids and their parents? I know you've heard this complaint before. How do you respond?
Well, first, I'm not sure about those numbers. There's not uniform accounting in school budgets. Generally, about 12% of children are designated as eligible for special ed in districts in the state, and generally the cost per pupil of a special ed student is about double that of a typical student. So normally you'd see a ratio of 12% eligible, about 24% of the educational budget. And my response is simple, that the children in special ed or kids with disabilities, if we don't provide the services, many more of them will be on state support their entire life. We are saving enormous amounts of money by providing them with the services and with the skills to live in the community, to get jobs, to function. And if we only take a small percentage of the special ed kids and move them from a situation of state dependency for their lives into a situation of independence and ability to work on the economy, we save many, many, many times what the special ed system costs.
I want to get to some phone callers at 860-275-7266. Kit is calling us from Greenwich. Hello, Kit.
Hi. My name is Kit Savage, and I wanted to comment on Dr. Falcone's comments earlier that there were policy documents that are going to be fixed and changed. And the piece that I don't hear from our school as a resident and taxpayer in Darien is how is our superintendent going to determine via hopefully an audit how those policies that were enacted all year hurt our children. Over 600 children had IEPs developed and changed based on illegal policies.
And again, IEPs, individualized education programs, for people who don't know the term. A quick response from Superintendent Falcone?
Well, we take a look at each student individually, and part of the PPT process is to make sure that we are doing that as a team. To the degree that I know that we have internally, and also our Board of Education will be, I think, in the short term, hiring a special investigator to review questions about IEPs and that situation. But I do want to say that every family has an opportunity to call a PPT to review a child's program, and that's important. But I do want to also say, in reference to what the Attorney Feinstein was saying, was that with respect to the budget, I want to say that services do not necessarily that the budget does not drive the services, that the services are first and foremost, that if whatever a student needs, that student, we are obligated to provide for that student. And if that is a very costly program, that's what we provide. Sometimes it's not. And we happen to live in a community in Darien that values education and supports students across the board.
Well, and I'll say quickly, and I just want to interrupt because we're running a little low on time in our conversation, is that many people around our state who are listening to this are also hearing this and saying Darien cares about education, certainly, but they also have more money than most districts. Darien seemingly should be able to pay for the special education needs of their kids at least as well as any district in the entire state.
And I think that is what we do. We provide for the needs of those students, and we also are in a position where we have to be responsible in terms of what we do fiscally. We will support and have supported our students in special education and all of our students to provide what we believe is the best for them.
I want to go to Molly, who's calling from Darien. Hi, Molly. Go ahead.
Oh, hi. How are you? Hi, Dr. Falcone. Hi, Andy. Hi, David. I wanted to call and say that I think it's great that we're having this discussion about special ed in town and that it will hopefully open up the people's eyes as to why kids in special ed matter and through the long term. So my question for you, Dr. Falcone, is now that we do have the at least preliminary finding from the state report, how do we go forward with Dr. Ossipuk's position? Because the parents who were told in the fall that the great quality that she possessed was that she understood the law. And we were told many times that she would help explain the law to us. And yet it turns out that she had either a deep misunderstanding of the law or she chose to neglect it in certain areas. So where do we go from here with the leadership of our special ed position? She's still on leave. She's on paid leave.
And Molly, I'll leave it there. I'll leave it there for the superintendent to respond. Go ahead.
Thank you. And what I can say that with respect to special education and with the state report, there are a lot of technical issues that we have to address. But from my perspective, the underlying focus here is on trust and the ability for us to reestablish that trust, to be able to pull us together in an effort to move forward. So as much as there is the technical issue, there is the relationship, the trust issues that we need to work on, and I'm the person who's going to be leading that.
David DeRoche from the Darien Times, I'm trying to figure out what's next here. We have this preliminary report from the State Department of Education. I know that you're looking for some other documents from the town, perhaps through the Freedom of Information Act. Maybe you can tell us what you think is coming next in the story.
Well, it's kind of hard to see because it's really been surprise after surprise throughout the whole story. What I think parents have the option to do is they could demand a public hearing with the State Board of Education to come in and do perhaps what they did in Bridgeport, maybe not as severe, but at least listen to the parents and the board in Darien. They could appeal legislatively. They could talk to the Attorney General, perhaps, the Department of Justice. Unfortunately, in 1999, the Federal Department of Education stopped allowing parents to appeal federally. This was an attempt to give states more control over the complaint process. So at this point, it's really unclear what is next. I think parents, like Molly pointed out, are very worried about the nature of who is going to run special education, and they're also worried about the nature of this investigation. There seems to be apparent conflicts of interest with the lawyers finding the investigator, and the lawyers may have been involved in overseeing some of these illegal documents. It's unclear whether that is the case, but there is the worry that that is the case.
And we'll have to leave it there. David DeRoche is assistant editor at the Darien Times. Andrew Feinstein represents parents. Stephen Falcone is the superintendent of the Darien schools. Coming up next, we'll be talking with Ellen Galinsky from the Families and Work Institute about her new book, Mind in the Making. That's next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Earlier this week, Ellen Galinsky, president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute, came to Hartford to meet with state and local experts in the fields of early childhood education and policy to talk about the work she's been doing in early childhood development. Hartford Community Schools was chosen as one of a handful of communities nationally to take part in her Mind in the Making initiative, meant to share life skills and give hands-on training for kids, for parents, and educators. Her book is called Mind in the Making, The 7 Essential Life Skills Every Child Needs. She joins us today in our studio. Ellen, welcome back to our show.
It's a pleasure to be back with you.
And she's joined today by Elena Trueworthy, who is director of the Hartford Area Child Care Collaborative. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
So, Ellen, I want to start with you. Maybe you can talk about what this Mind in the Making initiative is.
Mind in the Making has been a journey, and it was actually an accidental journey. I never started out to write a book or even to write a book on this subject. I was interested in youth and learning. We did a series of studies at the Families and Work Institute, the organization that I head, on how young people see the issues that they face growing up. One of them was to be on learning. And yet when I interviewed young people and when I talked to them about learning around the country, I found that too many of them were turned off by learning. They were just, you know, lifeless, disinterested, listless, not peppy, not I was filming them, not good film, when they were talking about learning. And that echoes the findings of a number of studies that show that children become disengaged in learning. And I thought of all of the young children I've ever met. Infants, toddlers, preschoolers are just on fire to learn. Their eyes are, in fact, burning brightly. So my question became, what do we do to turn off the fire in children's eyes, to dim it? And what can we do to bring it back, in a sense? So I set out in 2001 to film the very best research across disciplines, from neuroscience, from cognitive science, from different aspects of child development research, from literacy, numeracy, even experiments that have made a difference in permanently improving children's learning. And so to ask what can we do to keep the fire in children's eyes burning brightly? And now, 13 years later, here we are. I wrote a book that, because I found on the journey that there are certain life skills that emerge in children as they grow, and we don't think about promoting them. And all of these skills are based in one way or another on what's called executive functions of the brain. And once I found that, because at first I thought I was doing like a television show or something short, this was not going to be the rest of my life's work, although I've been doing this kind of work for my whole personal and professional life. Once I found that, then it gained even more steam.
One of the things that we've talked to you in the past about and that you've done so much of your work on is work-life balance and how families work. When you started looking into this, did you primarily see it as a situation of learning within the schools, or was there something lacking in the family structure where families weren't teaching in a way that kids were excited about?
I don't think I knew what I was looking for when I went off on this journey, and I think that's probably a good idea. I mean, I probably felt that there was something not going well in schools. I felt that maybe as families we weren't doing all that we could do to keep that fire alive. But I don't think I saw – I guess I was really asking questions rather than looking to assign blame in the beginning. And then once I began to see some of the situations, I mean, what I saw across disciplines were that when these, what I called, ended up calling life skills, these executive function life skills, that when they were promoted, that children would thrive. And it didn't matter where they were promoted. It could be a sports program, but then children could thrive. So that became the impetus for then saying, okay, once we know this, and we've been filming the research, we've been taking video cameras into the labs of the best scientists in many different disciplines, not only in the United States but in other parts of the world, and actually filming how they knew what they knew about children. So I think I really started out with a genuine question where now – going back to the way you just asked me, I did know that employers are complaining about new entrants to the workforce. Hmm. I work enough with employers and I go to enough events with them where as soon as you ask people, you just get into, let's say, a cocktail party kind of a situation, you know, it's after or it's in between the sessions in a conference or something, employers will start to complain about the new, you know, the kids these days, you know, the new entrance
soft
to the
skills
workplace.
They're called, yes, all the time, soft skills in the job, where people don't really know how to act amongst others. They don't know how to act as employees. Is this what you're talking about?
Well, I would disagree with the notion of people like Paul Tough and even Hechinger and Jim Hechinger and economists who call them soft skills. The skills that I identified, and I didn't come looking for anything. I found something. But what I found is that they're all based on social, emotional, and cognitive capacities. Each one of these skills takes very important cognitive capacities to master. And so it's just as important as – it's a different kind of learning, but it's just as important as learning math or learning algebra or learning a second language. In fact, learning second languages is easier when you have these skills, or people who know a second – who are bilingual or trilingual, who know multiple languages, have a heads up on some of these skills.
We're talking with Ellen Galinsky, who's president and co-founder of the Families and Work Institute. Her book is Mind in the Making, The 7 Essential Life Skills Every Child Needs. And we're going to be going through those life skills in a moment. We're also here with Elena Trueworthy, who's director of the Hartford Area Child Care Collaborative. They serve as local consultants through the Mind in the Making initiative that has brought Ellen Galinsky to Hartford today. This is where we live. Elena, maybe you can flesh this out a little bit more for us. Have you noticed in education some of the same issues that Ellen noticed that sparked her to write this book, this disengagement of children in the learning process?
I have, and I think what Mind in the Making does, and one of its goals is to create strong linkages and strong partnerships between the early care and education field and the K through 12 system. And so within early care and education, we have young children who are natural young scientists. They love to learn. The classrooms are set up to promote that type of curiosity and learning. And so Mind in the Making allows us to take that a step further and ensure that we're focusing and promoting these 7 essential skills with children since, you know, as of birth. And it continues up the continuum by creating the strong linkage between the two fields. And then what I also think is very exciting is that it's not only about children. These 7 essential skills should be promoted with adults also and are promoted. And so part of the training with the modules, I'm sure that we'll be talking about, includes adults and adult capabilities in our skills and looking at ourselves and reflecting and saying, how do these 7 skills match up with my life and how am I modeling this and how do I know this in order to be able to teach children?
I feel like one of those cable TV shows that is promoting ahead to what these 7 essential life skills is, but I'm not yet letting you know what they are. So let's actually talk about what these are. And maybe you can go through these and how you found these to be the 7 skills that every child needs.
Focus and self-control are fundamental. They're the notion of executive function life skills is that they involve being able to pay attention, that they involve being able to think flexibly and to remember what you're supposed to do and to not go on automatic but do what you need to do to achieve a goal. So how you teach that is you first look at what children do automatically to control themselves. We film children at birth, absolutely minutes after their birth, and watch them try to regulate themselves when they're stimulation. They'll shut their eyes. They'll, you know, put a thumb into their mouth or, you know, they'll turn away. So children are born with this, again, capacity to regulate themselves. But, again, we don't promote them. So the first thing that you do is watch what works with your child when your child gets, you know, out of control. And then do that with your child. Maybe with a baby it's switching a light on and off or holding a baby or rocking a baby, but building on what the children already do. That's one thing that you do. Then playing everyday games. Simon Says is a great example. Simon Says has lasted through decades because it is teaching these skills. If you think of it, Simon Says, you have to pay attention. You have to remember the rules. That is, you can't do what you're supposed, you can't follow the leader unless the leader says Simon says. You have to think flexibly because sometimes Simon says is said and sometimes it isn't. And you can't go on automatic. If you go on automatic, then you aren't listening to the Simon says part. So it emphasizes all of the components of executive function. Playing Simon Says is used as a measure of school readiness and school success. So playing those games. And finally, another thing that you can do to help promote these skills is that you can teach children strategies. That is, if you're going to a restaurant with a child who can get antsy if you have to wait for food, you can say to your child, we're going to a restaurant, what are you going to do to manage if there's a wait? And have your child come up with a plan. In other words, begin to give your children control. This is something that we learn in the workplace research. If employees have a little control, they're much more engaged employees. Same with children. If they have a little control, not, you know, indiscriminate control, but if they have a little control, then they can manage. So help them come up with ways that they're going to be able to wait, maybe bringing a bag full of toys to the restaurant or a book to read or crayons and a piece of paper to draw on or something like that. So there are lots of see, none of those cost any money, although those are everyday things that you can do. Do the same thing in your classroom if you're a teacher.
What is perspective taking? What do you mean by that?
Perspective taking means that you understand how other people think and feel. You don't think that your vantage point is the only vantage point. It's like empathy, but it's more than empathy because you have to have a cognitive understanding of the world according to other people. It's critical in business. If you look at Peter Drucker says that the difference between businesses that succeed and businesses that don't is that they know what their customers need and want. Okay, that's perspective taking. Admiral Mike Mullen, who was the chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, talks about going to different countries like Afghanistan or Iraq and not just hearing the history lesson, but really thinking about how these people who have grown up in a different part of the world and different traditions, different language, different culture, understand the world. And he was able to achieve all kinds of things because he really took the time to understand how other people think and feel.
But I just want to ask a question. For children, though, a young child, younger than kindergarten age, developmentally, aren't they much more me-centered? Are they able to developmentally understand this idea of what Ellen is feeling, what Ellen must be thinking right now?
It's a developmental process. It emerges at about between 14 and 18 months that children can really separate out that I might like something and you might not like it. So that happens fairly young in a child's life. Parents can see it all the time. The baby is crying and the child goes and gives the baby something that, you know, will comfort the baby. That is the beginning of understanding that the baby is having a different experience than I am. Parents who talk about their new babies when they have siblings as people, she's fussy, what do you think she wants, have children who get along better. Perspective taking is critical in conflict. The children who are most likely to fight with other kids, to bully, to fight, don't know how to read the behavior of other people, and yet it's essential. So there are everyday things that we can do in just asking, how do you think you're feeling in a room that doesn't have really good air conditioning. How am I feeling in a room that doesn't have really good air conditioning? You know, what's the experience like for you? What's it like for me? It's essential in marriage. It's essential in working relationship. When there's a problem in my staff, I will often say perspective taking. You know, how would that person feel if he got that email?
Yes, we're all sitting together in a room with not great air conditioning, I will say. I'm sitting with Ellen Galinsky, whose book is Mind in the Making. Elena Trueworthy is here from the Hartford Area Child Care Collaborative. Ellen has been brought into Hartford to work with the collaborative on her Mind in the Making initiative. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll find out more about some of these seven essential life skills every child needs. We'll be trying to find out how it's going to work in the community school model here in Hartford, next, where we live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking with Ellen Galinsky. Her book is Mind in the Making, The Seven Essential Life Skills That Every Child Needs. And she's in Hartford to talk with people here about getting some of these skills into the classroom through the Hartford Area Child Care Collaborative. She's joined in studio with me by Elena Trueworthy. Elena, before we get back to some of these essential life skills, maybe you can talk about the community school model that we're talking about here. What are exactly community schools as we see them in Hartford?
Sure. So, first of all, the Hartford Community Schools are the ones who are leading this initiative and this project of Mind in the Making. The Hartford Area Child Care Collaborative is serving as a consultant to help with the planning and implementation of the work. So the Hartford Community Schools model is a strategy for looking at the whole child, the whole school, and the whole community, and aligning the resources and wraparound services with the understanding and the philosophy that children, in order to be successful academically and in life, need to have supportive services that aren't included in the classroom. So, for example, health services, mental health services, after-school type program. And the parents also need to be a true partner in the work and the growth of the school and of the children of the community. So that is a little bit of the Hartford or the community schools model. Now, in Hartford, the Hartford Community Schools has been around for about 5 years, and it's led by a partnership called the Hartford Partnership for Student Success. And that's comprised of the Hartford Foundation for Public Giving, the Hartford Public Schools, the City of Hartford, and the United Way of Central and Northeastern Connecticut.
So when you talk to teachers about this work that Ellen has done, what do they say? What are they saying to you?
They are excited. They are very excited. There is just a lot of synergy and energy that comes about when you speak about these seven skills. And it's not only about the seven skills, but it is about the implementation of the work. And so this is a community-wide effort. We're talking about creating strong linkages and systems building, and we know that that has to include everyone within a community. And so that is a lot of where the energy is coming from. And it's also very exciting for the teachers themselves to have something concrete and easy to understand and to be able to communicate and work with parents with.
Now, Ellen, your book has been part of large-scale trainings for teachers, including recently at the AFT training conference in Baltimore. I guess I'm wondering if you can just tell me a bit about what you hear from teachers about this and how they feel like their current job that they have as a teacher in America aligns with these things that you're talking about in the book.
I do want to say that the Kellogg Foundation has funded this implementation around the country through community schools, and they came to us, interestingly enough, because they felt that there was a new catalyst needed to improve education. So although they're learning content, they're learning about the seven skills, it becomes more than that. It becomes a way of bringing people in the community together. It becomes a way of having parents and teachers learn together. It becomes a way of looking at children through their strengths, not just the problems that they have. It becomes a way of integrating the Common Core State Standards with early childhood. It's been a catalyst for so many things. What I hear from teachers is that it's been a discouraging period in education where we've had the No Child Left Behind Act. We've had sort of, okay, we've got a problem. There's an achievement gap or an opportunity gap, and it starts when kids are young, and it gets bigger and bigger. And so we've been doing more of the same, more hours, more push, but more of the same. But more of the same wasn't working. And we need accountability, but we've gotten to often teaching to the test. And so what I hear from teachers, I think the best example of what I hear from teachers is it's been like a light in a dark tunnel. We've been in a dark tunnel for a while, and now we can remember why we became teachers. Because it's research-based, because it has videos, so that you're always going into researchers' labs, so you're getting an opportunity that you wouldn't ordinarily get to take this field trip into the best research in this country on kids and their brain development and other aspects of their development. And because it's experiential, because it starts with the adult, because we believe very strongly that the adults need to see why these skills are important in their own lives and work on promoting these skills in themselves before. It's like putting your oxygen mask on before you put your child's on. We need to help the adults before we help the kids. It's just it's a different approach than they're used to. You know, it's fun. It's self-reflective. It's experiential. It's, you know, visual. It's interactive. It's you're meeting other people whom you haven't met throughout the system. So I hear that it's a breath of fresh air or light in a dark tunnel or reminds us why we're here. And I hear all the time that teachers are going above and beyond what they you know, they've had trainings up to the gazoo, and they're sick of them.
Well, sure. Yeah, yeah.
they say that they're spending 3 hours or 4 hours when they're not supposed to spend that much time because they get excited about thinking about themselves as learners.
We've gotten through two of these essential life skills. There's seven of them that you outline in the book, and so we should go through before we run low on time the rest. Critical thinking is one, and you mentioned the role in the Common Core State Standards, this idea of critical thinking. But you hear those words, and I don't think everyone knows what that means.
We define it as the search for valid and accurate information. In a world where there is so much information on the internet, on television, in the media, how do you know what's true? How do you know what to believe? Our democracy doesn't really function unless we know how to make good decisions for our communities. Our families don't function very well unless we are basing our decisions on what's accurate information. So it's helping children take the scientific, Elena described children like little scientists, and yes, children are born trying to figure out things, trying to investigate. They have theories about how things work, and it's taking that and providing a discipline to help them be scientists who can tell the difference between whether information is accurate or information isn't.
I'm wondering if you can talk about some examples of communication. You talk about communicating being one of the seven skills that kids need. Of course, we're in the business of communication, and communication sometimes can be very hard. What are some things that you can do with kids, whether you're a teacher or a parent?
Well, we mix up communication with literacy, and yet, as you know, because it's your profession and you're very good at it, that it really takes a lot of work to figure out exactly what you want to say and how you get us through this interview on time and covering the main points. It's not easy. What can adults do? I think that helping children think about what they want to say. I was in a classroom recently where a teacher took out a whole lot of books. The children were to pick their favorite books. And then they looked at the first sentence of the book. And they said, is this a good first sentence or isn't it a good first sentence? Why? Well, a first sentence should make you want to read the second sentence. Okay, well, what makes a good first sentence? And then they listed a series of principles that they could then use when they start to write. So that's a good example of communicating, of an everyday thing that teachers can do to promote the skill of communicating.
When you talk about making connections, what are you saying?
All knowledge is based on symbolic representation. It's the stand for relationship. I'm looking at the water bottle I have on this table, and you know, I know that it's a water bottle, but I can read the label on it too. And if I saw a picture of it, I would know that it's a model. It's a picture or a drawing of a water bottle. All of that, math, science, every discipline is based on the notion of something representing something else, numbers, for example. And so children, if you look at little kids, they are always putting things in different piles. It's just, you know, they're born wanting to categorize things, what makes a cat a cat and a dog a dog. And then, but most of us don't develop that skill. So helping children know how things go together, what things go together, why they're alike, why they're different, is the beginning of helping children make connections. But then helping them make unusual connections, which is the basis of creativity. And in this world, we need people who are creative.
The sixth of these seven is taking on challenges. Obviously, kids are taking on challenges all the time in school. What do you mean?
Well, actually, we tend to focus more on coping with stress, on helping children be resilient when tough things happen to them. And we do that with adults, too. But I think the next step for that, I think that's the first step, but I think the next step is to teach children to try the next harder problem, to stretch themselves, what in the business world would be called a stretch assignment, to try something that just feels a little hard. Sheryl Sandberg's book, Lean In, is arguing that women don't do that enough, that we learn not to do that. And yet, again, she's arguing, and research would indicate that those of us who succeed can try something that we're a little scared about. We can. My daughter says that the main lesson I gave her when she was little was fear means go. Sometimes you should stop when you're afraid, but sometimes you shouldn't.
But if right now we have an education system which grades are very important and test scores are very important, why stretch yourself if you might fail? Because failure, we've been told, is very, very bad in school. How do we get over this?
So why does GE have a program that's called Failing to Succeed? You don't solve problems in the real world, in the business world, unless you make mistakes. Every industry that's in R&D knows that it takes about 7 years from an idea to a product. So we wouldn't have invented stickies. We wouldn't have invented, so many things in the world. I could go on and on. Unless we had had failures along the way. We need to build the process of making mistakes into failing. I know one school that changed its grading system so that it wasn't an A, B, C, D, F. It was an oops for the first step, but it was saying that making mistakes is part of learning. We want to make mistakes, but we want to learn from them. And the way we praise kids is critical to whether or not we are willing to try something hard. If we praise kids for, oh, you're an A student, you're so brilliant, well, why should I risk that? I'm not going to try something hard.
But it's one of the big things that you probably need to change at the policy level, not at the teacher level, not at the student level. The policy level is we need to have accountability. We need to make sure that kids are being taught. And how are we going to do that? We're going to test the hell out of them. And if we do that, we'll know who the good teachers are and we'll know who the bad teachers are. Well, this idea of accountability has gone so far. People are afraid to fail. They're very afraid to fail. How do you break that?
I'm hoping that the research on how people learn and that mistakes are a normal part of learning can begin to make a dent in it. I'm hoping that when we come into Hartford and we start at the top and the bottom and the middle and their teachers, their families who are learning this together, there are superintendents at the event that we had earlier in the week. All of those people from the whole system were there. And if we can agree that we do need build-in time, yes, we do need some accountability. There's no question about it. We've gone too far. We need to, in education, we tend to go from one extreme to the other extreme. I've been around
like
it long enough.
Everything else in life, yes.
Yeah.
Well, a last one for you, because we have seven essential life skills that every child needs. You talk about self-directed and engaged learning. Self-directed learning is something that we maybe don't give kids enough room for.
And we need to. We need each child to have something, an interest that she or he is passionate about. Some of the best new experiments in education are based on the notion of being project-based learning, where you can have something that you care about, that you work on for a long time with a team of other kids, and that will make a difference. So learning, kids get glazed over by school because they don't see the point of it. But if they're working on something that they think matters, and kids are capable of doing that, you've seen collaborations in some of the schools between industry and schools where kids are like junior apprentices and they can come up with some pretty creative solutions. We've seen that in science fairs for years. So let's make sure that children have some time in their life for having projects, interests, passions that they care about, because that makes the difference between the kids who get onto drugs and the kids who don't, the kids who do well in work and the kids who don't, the grown-ups who do well at work and those who don't. Having a passion, if you don't care about it, if you're not engaged in it, you don't do well. Companies measure engagement because they know that it's a key to productivity. Why don't we get that in the early childhood years?
Ellen Galinsky's book is Mind in the Making, The Seven Essential Life Skills Every Child Needs. She joined us in studio today. Ellen, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Elena Trueworthy, who's director of the Hartford Area Child Care Collaborative. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you. It was wonderful to be here.
This is Where We Live.